Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Humans Excess Manchester with me, Clint Boone. This series is sponsored by our friends at Safer Roads GM, helping us keep ourselves and each other safe on the roads of Manchester. On the final episode of Series 3, I'm joined by DJ and broadcaster Paulette Constable, aka DJ Paulette. Paulette talks about her mum, who was a jazz singer in Manchester in the 60s and 70s.
When my mum was singing on stage with her band at the Free Trade Hall, that's when she went into labour with me and my twin.
And she describes being one of the first women in Manchester to become a DJ.
You know, not wanting to take credit for it or anything like that, but I think if none of us girls have done it, then it would have been a lot more difficult for the people now to come through, because before us, the only women who were playing records were on the radio.
I'm honoured to be joined in the studio by a Mancunian woman whose work as a club and radio DJ has seen her go from being one of the city's first female club DJs back in the early 90s to being one of the most sought-after DJs in the world today. Paulette Constable, yes. AKA DJ Paulette, welcome to Humans Excess Manchester.
Thank you very much. Happy to join you, Clint.
It's great to have you in, Paulette. We're going to talk a lot about your, obviously, current work in radio and in the clubs. Mm-hmm. But I want to start, first of all, by talking about where it all started for you. Where were you born? When were you born?
When was I born? Yes, so 1966. Right, there's a bit of a legend, actually, family legend, and it's supposed to be true, that when my mum was singing on stage with her band at the Free Trade Hall, that's when she went into labour with me and my twin. And she finished a set before they called for the ambulance and took her off to the hospital. So 22nd of December, she goes off stage like little, because my mum's only 4'11", right? She's a tiny little thing, and she was massive. And she'd been telling the doctors all the time, I'm sure there's two heartbeats there. And they said no. And it was, you know, 1966, they didn't have like, ultrasound or anything like that, and they wouldn't x-ray a pregnant woman. You just don't do that. So she's on the table, and along comes my twin, yeah. Paula, da-da-da. And then they say, "Ooh, Mrs. Finlayson, there is another." So 22nd of December, then there's all this like palaver because I'm the wrong way round, which is why they didn't spot me. Because normally twins lie head to foot.
That's right.
And we weren't lying head to foot. I was lying across my twin's feet, just underneath my mum's rib cage. So I was really well hidden and pushed up to the top. So they had to turn me and then pull me, and I had the cord round my neck and that. And there was like this big mission to deliver me. And then there my mum is with twins, and when she's been expecting one in the 22nd of December. So she says that we are the best Christmas present she's ever had.
It sounds like a beautiful Christmas present. So Paula and Paulette.
Paula and Paulette, yeah, get your laughs in now. This is 52 years of everyone going, Paula and Paulette, we're your family like, couldn't they think of anything better, or isn't it funny, or, you know, 52 years of great hilarity when me and my twin tell each other,
I imagine,
tell people it, our names.
As a parent myself, once you've got set on a name, they probably just had that name Paula, didn't they?
But and it then, wasn't, no.
Oh, was
no,
it
there's more legend, more family legend.
Tell me.
More family legend to this. Because my dad apparently used to send my mum to the hospital with a boy's name in a Bible. I'm the youngest of eight. So every time my mum went to the hospital to have a baby, my dad wanted a boy. And every time one popped out, he didn't get a boy. Like, my brother was the first, and he's like half brother. Long story.
Yeah.
Anyway, when it came to me and my twin, my dad did not send my mum to the hospital with a Bible with a name in it, because obviously he just thought, yeah, not getting a boy. So we weren't named. And we were taken home from the hospital, and I tell everyone, I have a vague recollection of this happening, is of us being sat on the top of one of these tall boys. My mum had this like writing, like a piece of writing furniture which folded out, and
a bureau. They call it a bureau.
It's like a, yeah. No, I think my mum called it a tall boy. I don't know why. Anyway, we were sat on there, and mum's like, what should we call them? And all the family had to go, you know, like saying what they thought it was, it should be. And my sister Elise said, I think they should be named Paula and Paulette. And they said, why? And she said, because it's cute. She was seven at the time. So 7 years, we were named by legend, whether this is true or not, by a seven-year-old.
Brilliant. Is she quite proud of that now?
Yeah, Alicia. Yeah. Brilliant. And I adore Elise. She's like one of my, I mean, all my sisters are my favourites. I've got a really good, tight, very loving family. So, yeah.
Your mum was a jazz singer, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Did she make any
cabaret? Yeah, she did make a record.
Did you make a record? Yeah. What name?
We had loads of them under the cupboard. We had boxes of them for years.
What are they called?
The album was called Now Tomorrow. You can still get it on disco, because, you know.
Right, go on. What was it?
It's called Now Tomorrow by Blanche Finlay.
So Blanche Finlay, is that the name of the band? Or is that...
No, that's her name. That's her name. Her band was called The Prophets.
Oh, wow.
It's really 60s cosmic stuff going on. But yeah, it was Blanche Finlay and The Prophets made this album called Now Tomorrow. There's a picture of my mum with the biggest Afro wig on and a ding, Colgate Bright, ding, like sparkly thing coming out of her teeth. I mean, it's just a classic 70s sort of photo. Like a more sort of an, I would say, shrunk down Earth, Wind and Fire sort of vibe, because it was saxophone, trombone, drums, keys. I mean, it's like a full, like, orchestrated workout.
Wow.
Or arrangements, really. Yeah. And my mum was singing covers like Tina Turner, River Deep, Mountain High. She used to sing show tunes, Aquarius, songs from Hair, Jesus Christ Superstar, that kind of thing. And then she wrote her own songs as well. So you'll see on this album, there's a track called It's Magic, and she wrote that.
And, I'm going to check
and there's
this out.
Another one called Chains and Gates, which she wrote herself. I mean, massively proud of my mum, you know. She made this, it was like a self-financed album in the late 70s, and she made it herself, and she used to lug it round to her gigs at working men's clubs at the weekend and sell it after she'd done a set. And we also had loads of them in the cupboard under the stairs.
And this is
years.
A mother. This is a mother of eight kids, as
yeah,
well, isn't it?
Yeah, and a mother of eight kids, and also a mother of eight kids who went through Oxford University 1969 to 1972, did economics, got a degree there. She went to Manchester University, did psychiatry, she's got a degree there. She worked for the City Council, was Equal Ops Officer for Women for a long time, you know, was there at the forefront of Equal Ops legislation. You know, she was working with it. You know, this is like groundbreaking stuff. And, you know, to me, she was just this, you know, she's just my mum.
Yeah, and what a massive, massive inspiration she must have been.
Oh, enormous. Yeah. You know, it's funny, there's things that I really like about clubs. And my mum also used to co-own a nightclub in Manchester. This is just going completely off piece. But she used to co-own a club called the Ebony Club. I think it was near where the Press Club used to be. And it was one of those clubs where, which again was groundbreaking because it mixed black people with white people.
Yeah.
And in the late 60s, early 70s, you didn't, honestly, you didn't really find that in clubs. So I've always, you know, there's been a culture or it's some kind of awareness of nightclubs, my mum singing, you know, going out at night at like 9 o'clock at night, all dressed up in a finery, evening dresses and everything, and then coming back smelling of fags and booze. And my mum never smoked in her life. Oh, you know, she used to drink Drambuie with three maraschino cherries on a stick. So 70s. But, yeah.
I remember the same thing, being a DJ, you know, when smoking was allowed in clubs, and I'd have to come home and just change the entire outfit, go in the laundry.
Oh, God. I mean, you don't realise. I mean, I used to smoke as well. For a time while I was DJing, I was like fag ash lil. I just had like 40 cigarettes going a day. It was ridiculous, really ridiculous. I was just lighting one with another. And then when they stopped, first of all, I stopped smoking, and then they stopped smoking in clubs. And it was just marvellous because you could go home and your clothes were clean. And then you go to another country, you know, like I go and DJ in Switzerland or Italy, and they were all, or Spain, and they were all still fagging away there, and it'd be just horrendous, you know. You'd be like, my clothes, it, like such a princess, my clothes are gonna stink, like anybody cares. It's like, where's your rave spirit gone? No, my clothes are gonna stink.
At what point did that spark then, from watching your mum and being in a house where, you know, music and nightlife was the norm, at what point did you decide you were going to have a go at being a musician? Because you were a singer before you were a DJ.
I think the apple doesn't fall far from the tree in one way, and definitely monkey see, monkey do. So I'd always see my mum singing. So when I was younger, I always used to pretend I was performing on stage, like, and I'd do little shows for the family, like, I'd be standing on the step outside our living room. There was a step out through the French windows to the garden. And I'd stand on the step because that was my stage. And I'd be performing and singing songs for my sisters who were like in the living room, obviously not watching at all. But I'd just be like, you know, in my head, I was on stage. And I think we all just did take that, and we were encouraged to do it as well. So my mum made, you know, she didn't make us all sing and dance, but she did encourage us all to sing and dance. And we did shows for people at community centres, and my sisters auditioned for junior Showtime. You know, it's just like, we were encouraged to do that. And I played violin at school. I played piano at school, did my grades and everything. So we were encouraged to be musical. We were encouraged to perform. We were also encouraged to excel at everything. So, you know, I did sport, I did music, I was academic as well. So, you know, we were just pushed into everything and then left to make our own decisions as to what we were going to do in life. And I just really wanted to either perform, or if I wasn't going to perform, I wanted to be on the other side of it. So.
Brilliant. Whereabouts in town did you live then when you were growing up?
Well, I was born in North Manchester General, Crumpsall Hospital. So we started off life in Prestwich and Whitefield. And then for a few years, myself and my twin and a couple of my sisters lived with my mum in Oxford while she did a degree, and the elder one stayed here with my dad. And then when my mum finished a degree in Oxford, then I spent most of my formative years in Fallowfield on Birchfields Road, opposite the bus depot.
Right.
Yes, mate.
What were the first records you bought when you started collecting your own tunes?
I remember vividly, the one I remember spending a lot of money on and sharing with my twin, I bought Street Life by the Crusaders and Message in a Bottle by the Police.
Cool.
And I shared that with my twin, and we bought it on import, 2 7-inch on import, at Spinning on Cross Street. Remember where Spinning was? And you go down the stairs. But before then, I'd had records. I'd been given records or bought records by my sisters. So I already had M-pop music in my collection. I had various other bits and pieces. My sister Elise gave me her copy of Aladdin Sane on the fold-out because I just knew every word. I learned, you know, from the day she got it, I just used to sit on the heater learning the lyrics and, you know, read the lyrics because they are, you know, they're not, you know, 7-year-old singing the lyrics to David Bowie Time.
Yeah. It's funny because I remember being smitten by Boys records at probably, I'm a bit older than you, so like 1972, 73, and it was one artist. I mean, I loved Elvis. I learned everything that Elvis ever sung. Mm-hmm. But David Bowie was like, I was listening to his records, learning the words because that's what kids did at 11, 12-year-old back then. But I was hearing phrases and words and the names of places that I'd never heard before. So the first time I heard the word Ibiza was in a Bowie record. The first time I heard the phrase video film or videotape was in a Bowie record.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I'd never, pop music had never been like that for me. And it was like prophetic, a lot
Amsterdam.
Of what he did. Yeah, totally.
You travelled the world listening to the lyrics of other people's songs. It's just like, for me, it was like being transported, you know, it's interesting that you said that you learned the lyrics because I think that's how I enjoyed music and albums and artists then. It wasn't just the sound of it. It was the words of it and the emotions of it, the emotions that were conveyed by the lyrics. And it was the song sheets, the artwork, everything all together made that really deep, rich experience of enjoying music. Mm. So now I think it's a very different way of experiencing music where people are streaming, you know, they're not even really touching anything. They don't own anything. There's no song sheet. There's no, you know, other than the sounds and, you know, for sure they're going to learn lyrics because there's lyric videos on YouTube, you know, that's how people are connecting with the lyrics now.
Yeah.
But there's nothing tangible to hold. And, you know, when I bought an album from HMV or something like that, I couldn't wait to sit on the bus to crack the plastic and then like have a little sneaky look inside and see if they put a song sheet inside because that was all part of it. So by the time I got home, I was like, just absolutely desperate to put it on the record player.
I'm still like that now. As much as ever I've been, I'm obsessive about the vinyl. And I'm going back through David Bowie's collection again now and just making sure I've got every single album on vinyl, which a lot of these albums I've never had on vinyl. Mm. So, but I'm really going through a Bowie phase at the moment. And a lot of the albums that you buy now, they're absolute replicas of the first release that came out, but to the point where they've got the David Bowie fan club.
Remember that whole thing about writing to a fan club?
Yeah.
I remember, here's the thing. I started going clubbing a bit earlier than I should have. And I remember going to Legends one night, and I'm a dancer as well. So I went to Legends one night with my friend from school, Gabriella, and we sneaked in.
So Legends is now Fifth Avenue, is that right?
Yeah. On, is it Princess Street?
Yeah.
Legends. And we went in, it was a Thursday night. So the Thursday night was the alternative indie night. And we went in, and ABC were promoting their single, Tears Are Not Enough. And in order to promote, and people used to do this in the olden days, like in order to promote their single, that they had like a nightclub tour where they just like pop up and appear and they do like little single signings. And they had a dancing competition. Can you believe that?
Wow.
Dancing competition. And I won. And I won the single, 7-inch single, Tears Are Not Enough, brilliant, which Martin Fry signed.
Yeah.
And then, like, so me and my friend Gabriella are like trying to stan the band, you know, as you do, shufting closer. And they're sat on this, there was like a little raised area overlooking the dance floor. And they're sat there with like champagne on ice and, you know, the whole band together. And Martin Fry just kind of shook this bottle of champagne and popped the lid on it. And it just sprayed all over me and my friend Gabriella. And we were like, oh, you know, standing underneath all soaking wet. And they went, oh, we're really sorry. Come and sit with us. So we sat with them all night. And I just talked about music with Martin Fry all night. And I asked him, what's your favourite record at the moment? And he wrote it down on the side of the single that I'd won. And he wrote, Controversy, Prince.
Wow.
And the label, and I still have that 7-inch and it's still in its sleeve, despite the flood that hit Ibiza, that hit the storage unit, that ruined all my record collection, this 7-inch is still intact.
Amazing. Did you ever meet Martin Fry again? Because he used to go to the Hacienda, didn't he?
I did. I met, he'd come to the Hacienda. I think he came to Flesh a couple of times. And I also met him because I used to work for Piccadilly 261.
Yeah.
And I did I was a junior reporter on a show that Becky Want and Chris Evans did called Saturday Express. And I interviewed Martin Fry. And it was just like, do you remember me sending a letter to you? Because me and Gabriella, after that, the end of the story, after that, we sent a fan letter to ABC, not knowing whether he'd get it or not. And we wrote it in different colour felt tips because that's how grown up we were.
Brilliant.
We were 18 and writing in different colour felt tips to Martin Fry. Yeah. And he wrote back to us and we have the reply. Gabriella photocopied the reply. I let her keep the reply because I got the single. I won the single and she got, Brilliant. So we have that.
You mentioned Piccadilly 261.
Yeah, Piccadilly 261. That's where I started.
And that became Key 103. Yeah. It's now the hits, isn't it? Do you remember the day, to me, when Piccadilly Radio was launched? It was a massive day because it's our own Manchester radio station.
Yeah, exactly. Because before then, we'd been listening to, was it Radio 1? Or we were listening to the BBC. It wasn't even necessarily Radio 1 as such then.
Yeah.
But when Piccadilly 261 launched, it's like, oh my God. You know, we've got this thing for ourselves, telling our news, playing our music and talking about our local experience. And it was massive.
Yeah.
And so that
was in the old building in Piccadilly. Which,
with all the randoms.
It's true, isn't it?
That building was, it was a real train spot. It was full of weirdos, that building, every day. I mean, every day that I go in to work at Piccadilly Radio, because I also worked in the record library for a while as well, and that was a hideous job. I hated it. with a vengeance.
Which record library? Sorry, the Piccadilly one?
Piccadilly Radio record library, Right. I did that for a big stint. I'm not someone who can work somewhere in a room without windows. And it did actually slowly drive me bananas. And people and the presenters always, once they know that they've got someone in the record library that is quite
obsessive,
then their PRS sheets just suddenly weren't filled in anymore. And every presenter would just be like handing me the pile of records they played on their show with a PRS sheet on top, blank.
And you'd have to
I'd have to fill them all in. Yeah. And in back in the day, that was, it's a big job, writing down all the details and how much time of each track was played and artist title, label, and then you had to put all the writers' credits down as well. You know, it's just like, oh my God, this is horrible.
But I bet the first day you did it, you probably loved it, didn't you? Because it was exciting.
It was exciting. Month three, bored.
What other jobs did you do? Was that your first job then, your first proper job?
No, that wasn't my first proper job. My first proper job was working for it was even worse than that. It wasn't worse because I earned quite a lot of money doing it, but I was an 18 plus management trainee for the CWS in Manchester, based at Balloon Street, you know where the old Co-op Bank is?
Yeah.
So I was based in travel and I was working in human resources. So first of all, I trained in building society because we had a co-op building society through the travel company, which is, it was the done thing in those days, but it doesn't make any sense now. And then I went upstairs to work on training and I had to write the training courses for 60 branches of co-op travel. I was 18. I didn't know what. I didn't even know.
It sounds like a nightmare.
I had to go from one end of Manchester to the other on the bus, let alone write the training courses for 16 branches of a travel company.
For a person of your age who was that obsessed about music back then, to be doing that as a day job, it sounds...
Oh, God, I wanted to put a bullet in my head. It was awful. Right. I mean, it was. It was one of those jobs that I think really was soul destroying for my sort of character, because I am a creative. I love music, I love art, I love film, I love TV, but just I like the creation of things. I'm not really my strength. I can do admin, but you know, I mean, that is like really sticking pin tacks in my cornea. You know, it's just like, this is just the worst job. And I hated it. And I did it for 2 years. And when I left, it was just the biggest relief. Yeah. I left and I always do that thing where I'll leave and then I'll be like, oh, I've got no money. Now what? But I'd rather leave and have no money and do what I want than have money and be doing a job that I'm dying in. I just can't do that. I can't do it. I've never been able to do it.
You got into DJing a bit sort of accidentally, didn't you?
Yeah, not sort of. It was totally accidentally because, I started buying records when I was like 10, 11 and I've just always bought records. I had a paper round, every penny from a paper round, I bought records. Then when I was at college and I got a grant, my grant all went on records. it went on records and secondhand clothes from Afflix Palace. Yeah. And then...
this is in the 80s, I
Yeah, in the 80s, late 80s, through the 80s. Yeah. And then... It was 1991, 1992, and I'd started dancing at the number one club and I'd been modelling as well, doing bits and pieces of modelling, and I'd started to get a name for myself, and a friend of mine told his friend that I had loads of records and she was putting on a night at the number one and she'd run out of money because she'd spent it all on hiring the club and doing the posters and doing the flyers and that kind of thing. And she didn't have any money to pay a DJ. And he said, well, you know, ask Paulette, she's got loads of records and, you know, you kind of need that. So she asked me and she said, look, DJ from 9 till 2, I'll give you 30 quid. And at the time, you know, 30 quid was decent money then. Yeah. So I said, yeah, all right, I'll do it. I've never done it before, but I've got the records. And she's like, great. And then I said, I haven't got any decks. I don't know how you do it. I've never played in a club before. Can I have a little bit of a tutorial or something like that on? And she said, oh, well, I've got a friend. He's got decks. We'll go and have a go on that. And we went round to a friend's house. I can't even remember the name of this bloke, but he would not let me touch his deck. And he's like, well, he's saying, you press that and then you bring that fader across and then you press that. And I'm like, well, can I have a go? No. I'm like, well, how am I going to learn how to do this if you don't let me touch it? He's like, well, I'll show you. And then just don't touch it. And it was painful. After about half an hour, I'm like, look, you're going to have to let me have a go because otherwise I'm going to be clueless. So he's like, all right, I'll let you have one go.
Put these gloves on.
Do you know what? I really can't remember.
I could totally relate to it though, because I'm like that with my vinyl.
Well, exactly. Now after years and years of DJing, it's what, 27 years I've been DJing now. Mm. And, you know, I know what I'm like with my equipment. And when I got burgled at the start of this year, it was just like, oh, you know, they took everything. And I was like, it's like losing a limb.
Yeah.
It really is. It's like losing a limb. And I know, you know, another friend of mine got burgled a couple of weeks ago. And again, they wiped him out. And it is a really deep trauma. You know, it's not like someone's just taking a piece of equipment. It's not like they're taking your mixer from the kitchen. It's not like they're taking a kettle or a toaster. For anyone who has played music that long, or is playing music as a part of their life, taking that piece of equipment, it's like, I mean, it really is. It's like taking a limb. It's like cutting off an arm or a leg. And because it was my original techniques as well, so they've taken one and left one. And they've taken both my mixes. And I'm like, God, you know, that's my life. Mm. That really is my life. That's 27 years of DJing and all the memories that come with it. And my decks have, I never ever took them out to DJ with them either. Right. So they always stayed at home. And for me, that's Manchester, London, Paris, Ibiza. They've been everywhere with me. Yeah. They're like really... like my music equipment is really, and I know it sounds sick, but it's like my babies. It's like, this is, it's my stuff. So yeah, I do understand that guy not letting me touch his deck. So I'm like, no, my pressure.
How did you end up at the Hacienda? Because you were the first, I think you were one of the first female DJs in the city, full stop, weren't you? But you were certainly the first female to DJ at the Hacienda.
Yeah, right? Well, me and Kath McDermott. Yeah. Kath was upstairs and I was, hosted the downstairs room for pretty much the tenure of Flesh at the Hacienda. And I, you know what, I did not really think about it in terms of male, female at all. I just thought of it in terms of rocking up somewhere, playing some records and doing my job.
Yeah.
And it was only much, much later that I realised, you know, like I'm reading a book and I'm thinking, where are all the women in this game? And then realising that the friends that I had who were female DJs, we were the only ones.
Yeah.
And then it became a bit more like focused on, yeah, we're kind of there at the vanguard of whatever this movement is, at the front of it. And because we're here, then other people hopefully will come through. And, you know, now there are so many more female DJs and, you know, not wanting to take credit for it or anything like that. But I think if none of us girls have done it, me, Princess Julia, Mrs. Wood, Rachel Auburn, Angel at Nottingham, Kath McDermott, I think if none of us had done that, then it would have been a lot more difficult for, you know, like Smoking Joe as well at Trade, you know, it would have been a lot more difficult for the people now, you know, your Annie Max, your Nicole Mudibers, Black Madonna, all of those women to come through. Because before us, the only women who were playing records were on the radio.
Yeah.
So it was Annie Nightingale and it was Janice Long, but that was it. You know, women didn't really get involved with music. And, you know, still, you know, as many as there are, if you put it on percentages, it's nowhere near a 50-50 still.
Mm, not yet.
Mm-mm.
Maybe one day, if you carry on inspiring people like that.
And ranting and getting political and beating my Suffragette 100 drum.
But that's all part of the same thing, isn't it? All that's intrinsic to me. If you a musician, usually musicians have got that sort of soul, haven't they?
Yeah, but you
want to make the world better, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know, one of the things I find really frustrating is still when I'm out DJing, how many women will come up to me and say, oh, you know, it's amazing seeing a female DJ, you know, we never see it. And I just want to scream. It's like, are you serious? This is 2019 and I'm still hearing this. That women do not see women behind the decks. And then I'll look at a festival lineup and then there won't be any women on the lineup. So yes, they're right. You don't see female DJs. It's still in 2019. You don't see an even split of female DJs on the bill. So that I find is very frustrating because it's not like there aren't any now. There are loads.
Yeah.
And if there are loads more female DJs, why aren't there loads more female DJs on the lineups? It just doesn't make any sense.
You've worked alongside some of the biggest superstar DJs who came in the world. You've probably worked alongside all of them, haven't you? have you got any favourite people out there that people might have heard of, DJs?
God, there's so many. But one of my absolute favourites is Giles Peterson. I did very many great memories of working with Giles. You know, I used to buy Talking Loud records. I remember playing In fact, here's the memory. Before I started DJing, I did a fashion show for Manchester University Fashion at the Toast Rack.
Yeah.
And it was their end of year fashion show. And one of the tracks that I walked to was The Young Disciples, Get Yourself Together.
Yeah.
And they played this track so much, I was like, I need to have that album. So I asked them what the music was. And I went out and bought The Young Disciples. And then after buying The Young Disciples, I was like, right, I'm buying everything from Talking Loud. So I bought Galliano, I bought pretty much everything that was out on Talking Loud up until that point. Yeah. I bought. So first of all, to me, Talking Loud was just this magnificent label that was putting out this new brand of like acid jazz.
Yeah.
I never thought for a minute that I would end up going to work for the label. It just didn't even cross my mind. I just respected Giles and Norman Jay and whoever else was involved, you know, Marco and Carlene Anderson and all the artists that were involved for creating this beautiful music. I think it was 95, and I was headhunted for a PR job at Mercury Records, and Giles called me and said, you need to come in and be interviewed by the head of press. We want you to come and do this job. And I ignored it. And then Eddie Gordon called me from Manifesto Records and he said, you know, we want you to come in and do this press job. And I ignored it. And then they were both calling me and just going, you know, why haven't you come in to do this? We need this. We need this PR. Who's going to promote all our music? Because we keep getting PRs that don't know what they're talking about. And at the time as well, I was writing for Mix Mag and Update and that. So they knew that I knew my music. Anyway, I went in for an interview, and when I finished the interview, I was like, there's just no way. I don't even know. I'd watched it turn from day to night in a record label. I'd never worked in a record label in all of my life. And by the time I got home, they'd left a message on my answer phone saying, you start on Monday. All the big key albums, like groundbreaking albums, and I was PRing it. I also had Lamb on Fontana. I broke them to the press. And on Manifesto, I had Todd Terry, David Morales, Masters at Work. Oh God, just practically every... I had, in fact, the first single I worked for Manifesto was Josh Wink's Higher State of Consciousness.
Wow, that's some
tune. So I had like, just that was my roster, and I'd never worked press before. I didn't know.
So it's like a dream job, but were you DJing as well at the same time?
Yeah.
So you had two dream jobs.
Yeah, it was mad. It was just this mad time where everything was just so right and buzzy, and the energy was just ridiculous. And I had the honour of working with all of those artists and some of the best people in the business. So yeah, Giles Peterson, he's still so enthusiastic. He knows his music, and it's every music. And, you know, from Manchester to Mali to Brazil, Giles is... musical knowledge is just phenomenal. And if I could have even a tiny corner of that capability, I would die a very happy woman, because his record collection is, what's it like, 50,000 strong.
That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And he, you know, he has his own radio station now with Worldwide, and he does the Worldwide Awards, and he has a festival in Set every summer, and he's now got this one in Cambridgeshire, and, you know, guess what? He's got an MBE as well, you know, so he's just, like, incredible. And he's, aside from all of that, he's just a really nice guy. And he is someone that I have had the absolute ultimate most amount of fun working with. Yeah. And, enough kiss ass. He's amazing. I love him to bits.
Let me ask you about another person that was quite influential. I believe he was influential and helped you out a bit. Anthony H. Wilson.
Massively influential to me. I mean, it's funny. I started watching Anthony Wilson on TV. I think he start on Granada Reports or something like that? So I was aware of him being on telly before being aware of what he did musically, I think he did shows on TV and talk shows and stuff like that. And he was always very news to me before he was music.
That's right.
And then the Oxford Road show came about, and I became aware of the music that he was involved with through Factory, Joy Division and stuff like that. And it's like, how could this person that was reading the weather or something or reading the regional news on Granada suddenly be this like almost Svengali for Manchester music? And then I worked at Granada and I met him, and he was always just an absolute gentleman. He'd always have, we'd always pass the time of day, chit chat. And whenever I saw him like wandering around the streets of Manchester, he'd always just be like, oh, hi, Paulette, you know, how are you doing? Chat, and just talk about anything, talk about music, talk about telly, talk about whatever it was. And he just was always super cool. And I just thought, that's Manchester to me. It doesn't matter who you are or how high you get or how high you are, just to be real and decent and still really enthusiastic and interested and just really push it as far as he could push it. That for me is Manchester.
The spirit of the city. I want to ask you about the spirit of the city. I mean, cause as a born and bred Mancunian who's lived in other parts of the world.
Yeah, there's nowhere better.
Nowhere better. tell us why. What is it about the spirit of the city that you love? I mean, it's hard to be objective when you are a Mancunian.
I say to people that if you cut me through the middle, that was what you would see. It'd be like, I have got Mancunian running through me like a stick of rock. You just can't. It's something that you can't even really explain, that as many countries as I've lived in, I've not been able to be anything other than a Manc. And when I first moved to London and I wanted to work in radio, and Simon Sadler, who was then the programme controller at KISS, said to me, you'll never work in radio in London because of your Manchester accent. And it was the first time actually I'd met like antagonism, not for being black, not for being female, but for being a Manc, which is just the most ridiculous thing. But actually, I became aware of there being a north-south divide by moving south.
Yeah.
And yet, even though there was that divide, the Manchester spirit is, it doesn't matter what anybody tells you, if anybody tells you no, and this is for good and bad, if people say no, you just don't listen.
You know what, you're not the first guest on the podcast to say that. We've had a lot of people saying that. If you try to tell us we can't do it, we're going to do it.
Oh no, it's the worst. Just going to do it. Even when I was moving back from Ibiza and people were like, you know, why are you going back to Manchester? It's a disaster. You never want to go back. You know, and I just had every reason why coming back here would be a bad idea. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's home.
Mm-hmm.
What can be wrong about going home? It's where my family are. It's where my life is. It's where my culture is. It's what I know. It's what I know, like absolutely down to the atom of it.
Yeah,
you know, it's like I know where I am with Manchester fish and chips. We don't mess about with, you know, and we don't, I know where I am with Manchester people. We don't mess about. We're just dead straight.
Yeah.
And if you don't like it, tough, you know, just, we're dead straight. We're really like sometimes a little bit harsh, but you know, tough love. But if we do love people, then we give everybody everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the most beautiful place to be. There are so few places where you can walk down the street and talk to anyone. And I know that's a standard stereotypical, this is Manchester, but it's true. That's how warm we are. We're accepting of absolutely everybody until they're not accepting of us. And then if you cross a Manc, then that's a mistake. It's a mistake and you'll live with it for the rest of your life. But then, you know, such is life.
Here's a question for you. What did your twin sister, Paula, what was her path through life? Has it been similar to yours or completely different?
Completely different. Well, I say completely different, but in fact, we've kind of got a bit close together as we've got older. My twin is a chaplain at a school, and this year she was elected as a councillor on Blackpool City Council, and she's the first black female councillor on Blackpool City Council, which is just an awesome result. She's just done so well.
Paulette, let me ask you this question. If I was to ask you, who are your favourite humans of Manchester ever, who would they be?
The first one has to be a Pankhurst. My first project in school, I think I might have been 8 or 9 years old, my mum still got the project, was on Votes for Women and the suffragette movement, and I would not be doing anything at all if it wasn't for the Pankhurst and the suffragette movement, which started in Manchester. So that's my first. My first favourite Mancunian would be my mum, Blanche Finlay Stafford, because she's just set the standard for everything, and she's as mad as a box of frogs, which is why I am as mad as a box of frogs. But I love my mum to bits, but she more than that, she is just the biggest inspiration and has been the person that has just said, don't take no for an answer, keep pushing through, just always try and be the best, and, you know, just try and do everything with dignity, and, you know, hopefully, you know, I've done just that.
Yeah.
And the third, it's difficult because, you know, there are so many men in Manchester, but Tony Wilson.
Yeah. And his name's cropped up quite a lot as well. And I must say, one of my favourite moments of these, the podcasts that we've done, we're on series three, but we had Ellen Pankhurst in here doing the same thing that you were doing, sat there in that same seat, and that was absolutely
inspiring.
Oh my
God, I must have like it.
I mean, she's like the...
I just rubbed myself on the seat to see if it rubbed off.
The great,
sounds weird, but...
The great-granddaughter of Emmeline Pankhurst.
Exactly, rubbed myself on the seat.
I could talk to you all day about... I mean, there's loads of things that you do that we're not going to get a chance to cover now, but you do a lot of work outside your DJ now.
Yeah,
you do a lot of
mentoring, teaching.
Helping people to, you know, achieve excellence in what they do. Before you go, Paulette, describe Manchester in three words.
The absolute business.
Paulette Constable, thank you for being a human of Excess Manchester.
Oh, thank you, Clint.
That was Paulette Constable. Thanks very much for joining us in this series. We've loved sharing with you the fascinating stories from some of Manchester's most inspirational people. Don't forget to keep following us on social media and subscribe to Humans of Excess Manchester. Rate us, feel free to leave us a review if you like it. And thank you again to our friends at Safer Roads GM for sponsoring this series, and thank you for listening. See you soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.